I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. Many cities are looking for ways to attract and retain artists and other creative types. Today on Smart City, we'll speak with people with fresh ways of developing a creative core for their cities. Helen Johnson and Josh McManus lead a group called Create Here that focuses on the artist in their own backyard in Chattanooga, Tennessee. Create Here is building a thriving community for artists, artisans, and creative entrepreneurs. Meanwhile, about 500 miles to the east, a group of creative and community-minded people were looking for a way to unite the creative community in the Raleigh-Durham-Chapel Hill triangle of North Carolina. They took inspiration from the world of open source software and created SparkCon, the world's first open source festival. We'll speak with Ali Khalifa of Gamil Design, one of the founders of the conference. All that, plus the latest news from Planet Edison and our City Views commentator Walker Smith, coming up today on Smart City. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Chattanooga has a long reputation for exercising civic will to transform what was a dirty industrial town. And our guests, Helen Johnson and Josh McManus, are continuing that tradition, but with a fresh approach. They have founded an initiative called Create Here that provides grants, fellowships, and even a relocation program for artists to help build and support the creative people in Chattanooga. Describe this unusual project, Helen, Create Here.
Well, Create Here really began on July 1st, 2007. It was a research and planning project in Chattanooga, and we were really focused on the engagement of creative, innovative, and entrepreneurial people and how they interacted in our city. So what we wanted to do was conduct research and surveys to develop an overarching plan for the community to lead us forward in a different direction. What we did was collected a lot of input from individuals. We did best practices surveys on other cities and took really that information forward in the form of initiatives that we got funding in order to create the Create Here strategies that we are using to, I think, invigorate the life here in Chattanooga.
Yeah, Josh, why did you care about engagement?
We were in a unique position to see a community that has come an incredible amount over the last 30 years, kind of a post-industrial economy that was at a place of being called on the national news the dirtiest city in America, to a very robust tourist and emerging green economy. We saw the opportunity with the physical plant and the shape that it was in to take this community to the next level through the power of people. And it's going to take all of us to continue the journey of Chattanooga from...
Helen referred to a focus on creative people, engagement of creative people. Were they necessarily, Josh, artists, or did you define creativity very broadly? What was the thought there? I mean, did this begin as an arts initiative?
It definitely didn't. We very broadly describe creativity, and so we know that a bread baker, an architect, a graphic designer, anybody that's really making work with their hands has a certain amount of creativity to their work. And we wanted to take that community conversation away from just being painting or drawing to being what we all have to offer the culture of opportunity in our community.
Where did this idea of Create Here, Helen, come from? What is it you were trying to accomplish? What inspired you?
We were inspired by the fact that there was so much enthusiasm in a certain age demographic, particularly to begin with. 24 to 35-year-old age demographic here in Chattanooga had been relatively untapped as far as their enthusiasm and the input that they were giving to the definition of where our city was going. We had done several events in order to garner enthusiasm and build engagement, and saw that what people were hungry for was that ability to interact with their city and help define the future of Chattanooga. With that in mind, we realized that there was an important crossover that needed to take place between folks who were mid-career and established and had the ability to offer experience and mentoring to the younger generation and to that emerging leadership. So involving creativity, involving cutting-edge thinking, innovation, progressive thought and action, together with different age demographics, ended up being a critical point of departure for Create Here.
Mentoring, that word is used a lot, and it
sometimes means different things to different people, different things in different situations. I'm curious about your approach to mentoring. I can imagine that if mentors were not selected well, it could really fall flat. I mean, intergenerational mentoring is kind of tough to pull off. How'd you do it?
There are a number of initiatives that we've launched that loosely use the word mentoring in the way that they approach the work. One of them is Arts Move Chattanooga, and with that initiative, what we're doing is relocating artists and artisans in particular to the urban core of Chattanooga. We don't in particular focus on a specific age demographic because we think that we would lose something by doing that. What we have found is that by defining mentorship loosely and offering opportunities for people who have that level of experience to engage with a younger demographic while they're living side by side has really sparked some very interesting collaborations and opportunities for artists.
I think really giving people the opportunity to interact is more our approach to mentorship than trying to contrive a solution that's not necessarily there. So with our Springboard program, we build a cohort of people that are described as startups, but this could be at the idea phase or 2 years into business and just kind of floundering. And what happens within that is everyone's at a different developmental level, and they start to gravitate to each other based upon needs for various assets that they're trying to build in small business. One other place that we do this is in just our networking and events type things. So I had lunch with the publisher of our paper today and just spent time talking about the future of our community. We try to encourage people to do the same thing, to reach out to people that you admire, to think about the future of the community and see where it goes from there. I think where we really see major failure in mentorship opportunities is when you try to force fit a solution and not allow them to grow appropriately from relationships that exist from events and other programs that you can put together for people.
I'm sort of curious, Josh, what did you learn from that lunch? And what do you think the editor of the newspaper learned?
I learned that there's a lot of people out there very supportive of emerging leadership, that are excited to see new people walking into new roles, and that they want to be asked for the knowledge that they can share. And I think that he probably learned that there's some interesting ways that we're thinking about the various types of work that can go on in a community. So we just brought back home very exciting information from a gathering that you're aware of. And so we shared some of that with him. And I think it's invigorating for both sides of the table to realize that when we meet in the middle, the opportunity for community change is much greater.
Mm-hmm. Let me come back and just get you to tell me about the rest of the programs that are embodied in CREATE here. You mentioned Arts Move, and you mentioned Springboard. What else functions under that umbrella of CREATE here?
Let me tell you a little bit about our arts grants program called Make Work. That's a program that's open to artists and artisans within a 50-mile radius, again, of Chattanooga's downtown core. We are looking at artists and artisans being defined very broadly, all the way from your fine painter, sculptor, to your culinary artist who's writing a cookbook or producing a distinctive cheese. We had 96 applications for Make Work this year, and we had a purse of about $150,000 to give away. We look at that purse as being an opportunity to stimulate the creative economy and to really be an infusion of capital into the creative community. It generated so much enthusiasm and so much interest in what went way beyond the 96 applicants that we were excited to hear back from even folks who did not end up being grant recipients, that what it did was encourage them that Chattanooga was a place that not only was glad to have creative people living here, but wanted to honor them financially. Make Work ended up supporting and awarding grants to 24 of those artists and artisans. And we have a range of projects that are catalytic, I believe, for community conversation and enabling these folks to reach into what they can do as far as their personal and creative evolution. We gave grants out in studio assistance, career advancement, and project grants. So it was a real variety of applicants. It was a real variety of projects that were funded. On the flip side of that, we also utilize jury members who are experts in the fields of arts and culture who were from our community, and then brought in final juror members who were from across the country, giving us, I think, an opportunity to show what Chattanooga is doing on a national level. One of the interesting aspects of Make Work is that it combines with our Springboard program, and we really encourage the idea of self-sustainability. What we don't want our program to do is end up being a crutch for anyone who is an applicant and a recipient. We want it to take them to another level and for them to be enabled to make it on their own after that grant cycle is over. They can't, in fact, apply for a grant for another 3 years after they're awarded.
And I think that's a good place to jump in and talk about Beyond Springboard, because we're really looking at things in a model of economic gardening, and that's been demonstrated with some success in Littleton, Colorado, and other places. But after Springboard, the incubation phase, that 8-week planning class where you take your idea to a business plan, we're currently looking at a program called Perspectives from the Edward Lowe Foundation, another one called Opportunity Knocks out of Washington State, and a CEO roundtable model, because what we believe is we have to give folks opportunity, no matter where they are in the creative economic development process, a way to maximize their potential.
It seems like the work you're doing, Josh and Helen, with Create Here, it's not easy to describe. I mean, it's not easy to put a simple handle on it. So tell me this, when will you know you've been successful?
I think we'll know we've been successful when we see a robust local creative economy that's self-sufficient and generating, ever-generating new ideas, new companies, new community programs, new community solutions to problems. It's sort of a sustainability and independence and creativity that I think any community would long to have.
I think, Carol, will also see a more sustained level of community engagement by emerging leadership. That's something that we're very excited about, growing ourselves in-house and out-of-house. One of the things that we haven't talked about yet is our Lead Here Fellowship Program, and we feel like that's a program that helps to build community leaders and really build tomorrow's leaders. We know that there's a huge gap that's getting ready to happen with the retirement of so many baby boomers, and feel as though it's essential to be preparing tomorrow's leaders to step into the shoes of people who've really laid the groundwork for so much that's happened here in our community. Our fellowship program is really designed to cultivate and empower young people within 1 to 5 years of college. We have an open-ended job description that says, basically, if you are a smart, motivated individual who has a passion and a fire in the belly, we want to talk to you about being involved with the work that's going on in the community. We give them opportunity to come in and autonomously manage projects, which is something that we need help with on any level. We give them the opportunity to mingle and dialogue with community leaders. They get into the community and visit organizations and emerging programs that they're excited about. They make a lot of those own decisions. They thrive on the cohort experience that happens within the walls of Create Here. Because of the success of this program, we've graduated about 20 folks in the last year, and that has encouraged us to reach outside of our walls and start to construct a citywide internship program that will offer the same kind of opportunities to folks who are coming to Chattanooga, whether it be locally or from beyond, to engage and plug in to this community in a whole new way.
Josh, you spoke earlier about the very effective leadership Chattanooga has enjoyed. As you said, they started Green Industries. They redeveloped downtown, built the aquarium, developed the riverfront. How do you follow that, you know, given the very different sort of pattern emerging of civic leadership?
I would say, how do you not follow that? I mean, these people who many of them we've had the benefit of them being mentors to us, have given everything they have and more to make this community what it is. And, you know, Chattanooga is one of those places where you say, you know, we stand on the shoulders of giants. We really stand on the shoulders of giants. And the interesting thing about Chattanooga is the list is too long to name, from community leaders to governmental leaders, nonprofit leaders and business leaders. Every bit of research we've done about where this community came from, you can point to people who put their foot down and said, no, this is not going to be a dirty city. Yes, we're going to go back to our river. Yes, we're going to reclaim our downtown. We're going to make our neighborhood safer and stronger. And we've thought, you know, many times about how you properly honor what's come before. And the most important way it seems in our eyes is to shoulder up part of the burden and go to work. And so that's what we attempt to do day in and day out, is try to follow in the footsteps of those folks. Now, one important difference that we see is the last 30 years has been very much about the physical plant. It's been to build a strong riverfront, to make sure that we have streetscaping downtown, to reclaim buildings that were falling into neglect. And the next 30 years is really going to be about putting the people in place that can take the community to the next level, ensuring that there's creativity, innovation, and entrepreneurial spirit everywhere you look within the walls and outside the walls of our community.
Do you think there's a way that young people, young adults, are going to act differently than the people who came before them in a civic sense?
I think it's impossible for the next generation not to act differently. The entire culture in which the emerging generation has been brought up is completely different than what's come before them. The emerging leadership engages civically in different ways. Technology plays a large part in how people communicate. One of the things that we also find, though, is that the face-to-face interaction has become increasingly important. The way that this emerging leadership also views diversity is very different. I think diversity is sort of a given and something that we expect to see. It's not something that we're going to endeavor to build in different ways. We expect it, and we think that our city's not complete unless we have a diversity on every level, to be quite honest with you.
Where do you find new talent, especially in a mid-sized city like Chattanooga? I think a lot of mid-sized cities are really wringing their hands over talent attraction, talent retention. But you seem, at least in to some extent, be content to work with what you have, develop what you have.
Well, you know, we've been playing around a lot with the idea of attraction and retention and have recently flipped that on its head and said retention has to come first, because our city is teeming with talent and teeming with potential. So much more often than not, what we fail to do, whether it's here in Chattanooga or I believe in any city, is to recognize the assets that we have existing. If we don't offer the opportunity for our young people and the people that have been here for a while to maximize their potential while they're here, and offering them the opportunities to engage civically, to engage creatively, then what do we have to offer someone who's going to relocate here?
I really feel like approaching people not with a job description, but to ask, what can you do? And what are you passionate about? The what are you passionate about question helps us in so many interviews, because all of a sudden we find out this person has tremendous graphic design skills, but they love to speak, and they love to write, and they love to take photographs, and they like to read these kind of things, and they were influenced by this in school. And the next thing you know, our job becomes just putting the right people together to make a program happen. And it can seem almost effortless from the outside, because you help people maximize in a way that maybe they didn't even realize they could, and you put people in teams that they don't expect to be in. But I think where you find talent is all around you. You just have to be willing to accept that it's there and be open to it may not be exactly what you expected it to be.
Chattanooga was just named one of the best places to live by Outdoors Magazine. Really made Chattanooga sound like a star. What were the attributes cited by the magazine that put Chattanooga on the list?
We are very excited about Outdoor Magazine, and we keep seeing Chattanooga show up on more and more lists and on morning shows, national morning shows, and all sorts of other places. But I think there's several very defined things. We're a very green city. We're a very blue city. And we're a city that has almost an infinite sense of possibility. It's a place that you can come to and plug in and be a part and make a difference. Helen and I, neither one, are true natives of the community. I remember the first time I drove through the Ridge Cut and saw the city all laid out before me, and I was probably 10 years old. And for us not to have a historical context in the community and to still be able to be involved in efforts like we are says that Chattanooga is a special place that wants people to be part of and proud of.
I don't want to let you get away before we talk specifically about the leadership structure of Create here, because you are its co-leaders. You are co-creative strategist of Creative Here, which in itself is not a 501c3, which I assumed it was, but you consider it a project. And so it's a very post-industrial organizational and leadership model. Talk a little bit about that and so the pros and maybe some of the cons.
I think that's an interesting question, Carol, because I think it throws a lot of people that Josh and I are team leaders of this project. It also throws people that this is not a 501c3. It is not an organization. We developed this structure to be a model because we believe that you can work more nimbly, you can work efficiently, and you can work in a new way. We want to be able to work quickly. The work that we do at Create Here is fast-paced, and in order for us to be program and project-focused, we need to have our financial responsibilities handled well and efficiently, but not necessarily in-house. Josh and I also bring very different skill sets to the table. My background is in fine arts and arts administration and in nonprofits, and Josh's is in fundraising and nonprofits. And by merging those skill sets in a unique way, we're able to multitask together and make decisions in tandem that bring a variety of perspectives to the table that I think empower us to be stronger as a team than we would be separately.
Yeah, absolutely. I think leadership and the way we look at leadership is going to change just as the rest of culture is changing around us. And being an emerging urban citizen has new definitions, has new constraints. It's hard to stay aware of everything you need to stay aware of and to raise a family and to spend time with your partner and to do all the things that you're passionate about on a volunteer scale. So we really feel like we're trying to cross new ground and make a more powerful leadership structure by sharing our combined assets, but to become one voice back to our community and to the people that we work with.
And Josh, you said there's a new definition of urban citizenship. Tell me what that new definition, what are we moving toward?
You know, we were talking about this earlier today, and I think it's interesting because of the proliferation of information. 30 years ago, it was hard to be a subject matter expert in more than one area. So let's say it's environment or neighborhoods, because you had to have subscriptions and books and magazines and things that just had cost and time associated with them. With information everywhere, you have people that can jump through and really be subject matter experts in local food economy, in neighborhoods, in urban redevelopment, in all sorts of things environmental. And so I think what we're heading to is more of a city citizen who has an awareness on all fronts, who expects a lot out of what that living experience is going to be like. And I think that's really quite empowering for us to think about. There's an entire model change that may be coming as to how we interact with each other and with our cities. But information is making all the difference in the world on that front.
Well, I appreciate so much what you're doing. I think you are creating an interesting new model for all of us to watch, and we will watch it. Helen Johnson, Josh McManus of Create here in Chattanooga, thanks so much for being our guest on Smart City.
Thank you, Carol.
Thank you, Carol.
Helen Johnson and Josh McManus are the co-founders and creative strategists for createhere.org. They joined us from the studios of WUTC in Chattanooga. For the latest news in the world of urban planning and design, we turn to Nate Berg, assistant editor for planetizen.com.
There are planners and there are politicians. When their worlds overlap, that's when the trouble starts. But trying to draw that line between is increasingly difficult for many cities. That was a sentiment of a group of 7 North American planning directors who were all in San Francisco last week. Streets Blog reports on the discussion, which included planning directors from San Francisco, New York, Portland, Seattle, Vancouver, Minneapolis, and San Diego. Many of them bemoaned the fact that the planning process is too tied to the politics of city government, and that connection holds back progress. The other limiting factor for many of these planners is simply the mistakes of the past. Bill Anderson, planning director for the city of San Diego, says the field needs to move away from a focus on preventing bad things from happening and towards enabling good plans and ideas to thrive. And perhaps Anderson's wish is coming true, at least within his state of California. A new project was recently announced that seeks to create a detailed strategy for growth in California. The San Francisco Chronicle describes the effort, which is being spearheaded by the Cabinet-Level Strategic Growth Council and the California High-Speed Rail Authority. Just $2.5 million has been set aside for this effort, which aims to create a, quote, preferred scenario that local governments can use to approve or deny new construction projects. How well the effort works remains to be seen, but based on past experience, even the best-intentioned plans may still go by the wayside. A similar statewide planning effort in 1978 offered forth a list of suggestions and policy changes, but no formal plan ever materialized. And when it comes to things not working out as planned, planners seem to be used to the disappointment. But when there are billions of dollars of public money at stake, that pill becomes a lot harder to swallow. So you kind of have to empathize with transportation planners in Denver, where their ambitiously timelined Fast Tracks light rail system is coming up against major budget shortfalls and operational speed bumps. The 122-mile system was slated for completion in just 12 years when it was approved in 2004. But as the New York Times reveals, the expected cost of the system has risen almost 50%, from $4.7 billion to nearly $7 billion in just 5 years. Denver voters again may be asked to approve a sales tax increase to fund the plan, much of which is still just an elaborate idea on a very expensive drawing board. For Planetizen, I'm Nate Berg.
Nate Berg is the assistant editor of Planetizen.com. Coming up after the break, we'll speak with Ali Khalifa. He's one of the founders of SparkCon, an open-source festival for artists and creative people and their work in Raleigh, North Carolina. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta, and you're listening to Smart City. Raleigh, North Carolina is one of the nation's most successful cities, thanks in large part to Research Triangle Park and the presence of powerful universities. But art has never been central to Raleigh's brand, and that's where our guest Ali Khalifa enters the picture. Ali was one of the founders of Design Box, a design collaborative in Raleigh, and he used his experience there to create SparkCon, a new way of showcasing the work of artists and other creative people in Raleigh. Ali, on a recent trip to Raleigh, North Carolina, I met your partner and learned about Design Box. It's an unusual way to organize design professionals in a community. Tell me about it.
Yeah, well, Design Box was formed as a creative collective. Really, we found that in our own design firm, Gamil Design, that we had marketing challenges, we had spatial challenges, a lot of things that a small design firm has, and we realized that there's, you know, a lot of people out there that have the same kind of challenges. So we had a series of meetings, kind of open meetings within the community, and said, well, if there is a thing called a design box, then, you know, what would it be? And so through that, we were able to form this organization where we could share space, although not all Design Box members share space. We can share a gallery that we open up to the public. Each of us takes turns in curating that show and kind of reaching out to the community. Otherwise, we just meet every week. We help each other brainstorm different projects. So you sort of benefit as if you have like a big company staff working with you when you need those times. And the rest of the time, you have your own private space and work on your own. It's a loose collective. It's a little bit of a controlled chaos. But so far, we've been gaining membership and really been able to do more and more.
So some of you actually work in the same building and share amenities, and others are simply members of the collective but don't actually office in the space. Is that right?
Yeah, we thought that the most important aspect of a network was really the people, not necessarily the space. And in order to really have a functioning group where we can get ideas from a whole variety of people, we thought the focus was really on the membership, and being a member was the most important thing. But we've also realized that in the information age, that if you don't have an address, if you don't have a central location space for everyone to get together, then everything starts to disappear or become too abstract or easy to not really participate.
You didn't think you could do it online?
No, we wouldn't have the same kind of culture that we've developed online. Not at all.
How does an organization like Design Box, this creative collective you call it, help grow the design community in Raleigh?
Well, you know, we saw within our own design firm, we're a product and graphic design firm, and within our own firm, we realized that we're getting a lot of very interesting work and a lot of diverse projects. But if we tried to do everything in-house, we weren't necessarily hitting the mark. And so we realized we were kind of reaching out to some freelancers and reaching out to other local talent. And there being a design school in the area, it was just very rich with that. And so we were able to reach out to more people by using freelancers, and we frequently found the best ideas were coming from outside the firm. And so we realized that by forming Design Box, we could do that in a little more of a formalized way and also, you know, cover the confidentiality and all that stuff. And so what it does, we're able to activate all these other groups. They're able to activate us. And that keeps spreading tentacles kind of throughout the community.
I heard you complain in a recent presentation that one major city agency, I can't remember which one, perhaps the Tourism Bureau, brought in a Toronto design firm to do its work, overlooking the local talent that was available to them. And that's a complaint, Ali, I hear often. But I assume you're seeking work outside of Raleigh. I'm sure you want to be the Toronto firm that sweeps into another town and grabs the business. So what's the difference and what's fair in terms of, you know, using local talent, evaluating local talent for big jobs?
Well, I mean, I think in the end, you know, the job should go to the most qualified party. So I don't think there's any hard feelings one way or the other. I think in terms of due process, that if you're talking about creating the identity of your local area, that probably looking first, or at least prioritizing to get someone local to help you with that kind of a project would make the most sense. And I'm just talking from a kind of a creative direction, that you're going to have more insights from someone who is close by. So I think for particular projects like that, it's great to have local people because you do have some interesting insight. And not only that, you're going to get these people to work the extra hour, unbillable hours to work on something because the pride of what they're working on.
And so that was the project, developing the identity of Raleigh.
Yeah, it was by one of the agencies in the city.
What was the outcome?
I think it's still to be decided. I think the work is ongoing right now, so we haven't seen the full rollout of that. No, it's not the only example of that. We've seen the same thing happen with our state museums and a lot of things where the work is hired out. And I think in a lot of cases, probably most of the cases, it's justified. But I think in other cases, it's not easy for the people who are awarding those jobs to fully understand, you know, how good the local talent can be. In a growing city like Raleigh, there's always this, a little bit of this feeling of, if it is from here, it can't be good.
Mm-hmm. How does Design Box help smash that image?
Well, one thing we've done is, you know, we're very community-minded, and we found that was probably the most important characteristic of our membership. I mean, to be a Design Box member, you have to be established in your community, in your profession, you have to establish yourself and present a portfolio, and there's a lot of things that we find, but probably the most important characteristic is for someone to be community-minded. And Design Box has worked very hard in the community doing charrettes to talk about how to design, you know, a landfill into a city park, or how to work on the image of the city for the convention center, or to do a variety of things like that. Really, just because we're already reaching out to each other in a small way as Design Box, and then you just can't help but reach out to the surrounding environment. There's a thing they say about creative people, which is they're never really satisfied. And if you are fully satisfied, how could you be creative? So there's always this creative discontent that's out there, and a creative person in their environment isn't ever going to be satisfied. And so we try to nurture that as long as we can kind of keep pushing towards constructive projects.
How did Design Box, and specifically a product design firm, get involved in designing a landfill? That's really interesting to me.
Well, it was a project that just presented itself. It's one of those things, you know, if sometimes you see something fell over in front of you and you feel like you need to pick it up. And we...
That's a great... I love that image.
To us, there was just an opportunity that came right along. We saw that there was, you know, a bunch of dirt being dumped next to a neighborhood, and it looked like it was shaping up to be one of those classic political battles between yes and no versus, okay, how? And so we just sort of presented that, you know, if we use the design process, if we get all the people who are involved with this dirt one way or the other to take a look at it, then we can all design it together. So as a product designer, I wouldn't say that I really didn't have much content I could help with. I didn't really know anything about it. But at the table, we had bulldozer operators who could tell you a whole lot about moving dirt. And just through the management of the design process, making sure that, okay, here on this, you know, during the next 20 minutes, we're going to be creative and throw out a bunch of ideas. And during the next 20 minutes, we're going to start making decisions. After that, we start looking at implementation. And we, through doing all that, you can have a lot of people who aren't necessarily content experts, but who can lend a unique perspective.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Ali Khalifa. of the firm Gamille Design and the Design Collaborative Design Box, we're speaking about using a collaborative design process known as a charrette to bring a sense of design and purpose to dirt in his hometown of Raleigh, North Carolina. And so what was the outcome of that charrette process?
Oh, that was a really satisfying one. I guess in the end, I think we had about 88 people in the charrette. And again, it was like city planners, bulldozer operators, it was parents with children, and it was all kinds of people, everyone who might be impacted by that. Really, this what was originally planned was to take 4.2 feet of dirt and evenly distributed across this section of land that was next to a neighborhood, which would wipe out a whole stand of pine trees. That was just sort of the easy engineering calculation to do, not really kind of thinking about what would happen to the rest of the surrounding areas. What we ended up coming with is saying, we'll take the same amount of dirt, we're just going to place it differently. And so it became a raised soccer field with a bowl of dirt all the way around it. And one of the insights we heard was from parents saying, the older kids are playing soccer, the younger kids are usually running away the opposite direction. So if we can make that an uphill battle for them, it'll help me contain my kids. But we also have like a vantage point, which is one of the higher points in this entire part of the city. We get a really nice view over the tree line, actually. And then a third feature was an amphitheater where we could sculpt the dirt into sort of another bowl shape so we could have some music and other things during the summer.
So this went from being simply a pile of dirt that was going to be a real nuisance to a neighborhood to a mountain, an amphitheater, and a child protection barrier. And that's not a bad day's work.
No, we were very happy. And, you know, even the original city planners who had just kind of talked about 4.2 feet of dirt, we had them in the charrette as well. And they were talking about, you know, butterfly gardens and all kinds of stuff. I mean, once they were sort of embraced, you know, at a table to talk about their ideas, I mean, it was amazing the kinds of things people came up with.
Well, Design Box has spawned an open source conference. You call it, I think, a potluck creative festival. It's now in, its third year?
Yeah, it's only its third year.
And it's called SparkCon. What was the inspiration for SparkCon?
Well, you know, we were talking a bit earlier about identity and place, and we had been through a workshop with the city talking about, okay, what is our identity? What should we really be focusing on? It was a charrette that we had facilitated. And we were just reflecting that. We have these weekly Design Box meetings where, you know, you never know what's going to come up. You have a whole lot of creative people sort of jazzed for an hour and a half to talk about new things. And a cartoonist, one of the Design Box members, Paul Frederick, said, well, you know, Raleigh doesn't have a river, you know, unlike a lot of other southern cities. But we keep hearing that we're creative, so why don't we just claim that? That was really the seed for SparkCon, was saying, well, if we just claimed creativity, what would that mean? So we sort of came up with this tagline, we're the creative hub of the South. If you're going to have a tagline like that, then you better start working towards it too. I think taglines should always be a little bit aspirational. There are a lot of creative people here, and what we really need to do is connect them. And the way we first started looking at it was, you know, maybe I just get hungry a lot, but we were thinking about soup. And you have all these different ingredients in a soup, but someone has to stir it to kind of make all these connections and really make that soup work. So we said with this festival, let's think about a soup. Let's put a stone in there. We'll do a stone soup, and that stone is going to be some workshops and some charrettes about, you know, how we can sort of start connecting things and do things better and really try to get the creative talent of the triangle together. All of a sudden, someone would say, well, you know, there's a lot of fashion designers here. Why don't we have a little fashion show with that? And so that was sort of like throwing carrots in the soup. And someone else said, oh, I've always wanted to have this image slam where we could have artist stuff on a big screen outside. So those are the potatoes. And before long, we had, you know, a whole bunch of different things and a lot of people activated into this, creating this festival. And it's really kind of taken a life of its own. And the trick has been organizationally to make that sustainable.
Well, how do you make it sustainable? What's the glue that holds it all together?
Well, the first year, you know, we didn't really know what to expect, and it was a snowballing effort for sure. And unfortunately, the organizational structure was sort of like a snowball, you know, and everything was sort of surrounding the people who were initially coming up with the ideas, and all of a sudden they found themselves in organizational roles and a lot of times a bottleneck on information. And we realized for this thing to grow sustainably, we really had to decentralize because SparkCon isn't funded, you know, in any way. This is a complete grassroots effort. So what we'd really need to do is reach out to the people who would take a leadership role and give them enough autonomy that they can do the things they want to do and make it work with what they want to do. We don't want them to do stuff for free. We just want to show what they're already doing. but somehow make it structured enough that all these people could be networked in such a way that we can get the chance encounters, which actually creates those connections, which will strengthen the city.
I love this idea, as you know, as I told you in New Orleans when we first met. But I really want to understand how it works. So what do you centralize? What do you decentralize? And how do you know where that line is?
Well, you know, there's a wonderful book, Spiders into Starfish, which gives some ideas about how a decentralized structure can work or a leaderless organization can work. We've been studying, you know, kind of a lot of different books to try to get it, wrap our heads around something, because we felt like we struck a nerve and there was a giant reaction within the community. And then the trick was, okay, well, how do you kind of harness that? There's some great examples. I mean, Wikipedia is a great example of something where a whole lot of different people are participating and contributing to something for free, yet there's also some really good information in there. And what we realized, and again, from the Spiders into Starfish book, we could see some of these other examples like Alcoholics Anonymous or other organizations that also use a decentralized structure. Usually there's a kind of two key people, or this is my interpretation of it, which is there's usually two key people in there. One is kind of like internally focused to make sure that the vision is there. If you're going to do a fashion show, that you have someone really focused on that. And so you have a real visionary there about what it should be, what it should feel like, and where it should be, and things like that. But then you also need a champion. And that's the person who's going out to the community. And usually the champion is the person everyone thinks did it. And usually it's the visionary that actually held everything together. But you need both sides. You need someone internally focused. You need someone externally focused. And they need to work as a good team. So we've said in every Spark for SparkCon that we'll give you a spark. You can be your own spark. You can be Fashion Spark, or you can do a street painting festival and be Ground Spark, or you can do all these different things, but you need to have at least those two people. One who's really going to kind of hold the plan, and the other one who's going to be out there going to all the meetings and communicating. And that, those two people usually work well together.
So if I travel to Raleigh September 19th through 21st to take part in SparkCon, what will I find?
We've got Ground Spark, which is a street painting festival. It should be more than 300 artists. I think this year they're expecting maybe close to 400 artists that'll all be just taking chalk to pavement and just taking over an entire street and decorating it. They do some just beautiful things there. But there'll also be a fashion show. Everything has to be at least 50% local. We really want this to be about local talent as much as possible. We have an image slam, which is more than 100 artists with about three or four slides each projected onto a big screen in the park where everyone can sort of feel like, all right, there's an artist gets to be a rock star for a few minutes. We'll have a shopping bazaar. We'll have spoken word performances. We'll have storytellers, graffiti artists, body artists, you know, tattooers and piercers. There'll be workshops. There'll be yoga lessons. There are going to be all kinds of different dances going on. Always a big component of SparkCon is music, music from indie music to hip-hop to bluegrass to club stuff. We're going to also partner up with the Museum of Natural Sciences, which is doing Bug Fest, calling that Bug Spark, and you'll get to eat insects even.
So when there's Yoga Spark and Bug Spark and Fashion Spark and Music Spark and Ground Spark, all these different things, I take it that each one of these then has that two people, one of whom takes care of the inside, one is the champion, and each one of these aspects of SparkCon has the same organization. Is that right?
I'd named a kind of two arms of the starfish. There's a few other components that makes a spark really happen. In Wikipedia, you might see that there's norms, that when you define a word, there's a specific way to do it, and you don't necessarily tell people how to define the word. You just say, but here's the norms about how we like to have words defined. So we have an organizational structure in terms of you have your spark sheets. You have these things that you have to fill out saying, okay, here's what you're going to do. Here's how you're going to do it. An entire wish list of what they're going after, how they're going to do it. And we really kind of try to coach people to develop a full plan. And that same plan applies towards all the sparks. So they're all filling out similar paperwork, if you will, or really more likely web work to really kind of explain exactly what they're doing. Another big component is to tap into existing networks. And that's a crucial thing. I mean, to try to say we're going to create fashion designers isn't really our intent. What we want to do is just find all the ones that are already there and say, hey, we'll give you, you know, your time on the runway. We'll give your time on the to do street art or to play your music at this club or something like that.
Is there quality control?
Yes, absolutely. One of the key things for every component is that, you know, these two central organizers, a lot of them have a lot more people working with them to help them. There's usually a call for entries, so we try to reach out to the public and don't let this thing become too cronyish. And we really want to make sure we're always reaching out. But at the same time, there's always a jury. And at a certain point, after we get all the submissions, then we will make decisions about what really fits what they're trying to do or what will work best together.
But still, it's the responsibility of the decentralized leaders of each of these SPARCs to determine the quality or determine who can participate and who can't.
Yeah, that's exactly it.
And then one of your norms is that they will always go to the public and solicit new participants?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, you know, and sometimes we get these great opportunities. Sean Lennon wanted to show a film at our Film Spark, and this was going to be a national viewing of a new music video. So it was great to be able to have that opportunity. It wasn't something like we went out to the whole world and said, you know, get us your national previews of films. So if opportunities come along, they get worked in a lot, and we try to be flexible and not too rigid in our structure that way. But for the most part, yeah, we try to reach out and make sure that each year people have a chance. It's a grassroots movement, so we know it's snowballing. We know every year we're not reaching all the people we want to. We know there's a lot of people who haven't heard about SparkCon, so we just want to make sure we're doing our part to reach out and connect and hope that over time we do start to reach everybody.
What difference do you hope SparkCon can make in Raleigh?
There's a growing class of people who are very creative, who have great ideas, who really have a lot to contribute, but maybe at some level don't feel empowered to really contribute to the community. And what we think, this is a possibility to really be a community builder for those who don't necessarily want to be in government or, you know, make it a full professional choice. They really want to do their artwork. They really want to do their things. But it's a chance to actually get together and cross-link and connect with each other. And so what we really hope is we actually have the creative people, all these guys with great, you know, ideas, actually getting their voice out there. That would be a huge thing. Also, we've been able to see some of these people start to come up as community leaders that having a few tools behind them, they immediately become just as good at, you know, organizing as they might with a paintbrush. And you realize that they have some real skills of putting things together, and to watch leadership emerge from that community is really cool.
Ollie, thanks so much for being our guest on Smart City. I'm going to see you at SparkCon.
Oh, great. Thank you so much, Carol.
Ali Khalifa is the product design director of Gamil Design and one of the co-founders of SparkCon. SparkCon 2008, the third edition, will take place September 19th through the 21st in Raleigh, North Carolina. You can check out sparkcon.com for more information. His interview was engineered by Blazing Music and Sound in Raleigh. This week, City View's commentator Walker Smith says it's the extraordinarily bad things in the headlines that fuel a certain trend in our society.
Doom and gloom are booming again. Worries about the economy, the environment, and energy have spurred yet another spike in stockpiling. Jim Rawls, editor of SurvivalBlog.com, reported in an April New York Times story that visits to his website have more than doubled over the past 11 months. No longer frequented only by right-of-center survivalists, more and more of his visitors have left-wing or centrist political leanings. Many survivalists can now be found in middle-class suburbs, not just living off the grid. Pop culture has helped fuel the recent surge in survivalistic sentiments. Cormac McCarthy won a Pulitzer Prize in 2007 for his extremely dark post-apocalyptic bestseller, The Road. That same year, Booker Award-winning author Jim Crace published The Pest House, yet another take on life after an apocalypse. A survivalist sensibility informs hit TV shows like Survivor, Lost, and Jericho, as well as recent movies like I Am Legend, or the Spielberg remake of The War of the Worlds. In fact, the same year that the Tom Cruise version was released, two other versions of The War of the Worlds were released straight to video, one so successful that its studio is planning a sequel. This recent spike of interest in survivalism is nothing new, though. It spiked after 9/11, it spiked before Y2K, it spiked in the early 80s during the last days of the Cold War. It spiked during the oil crises of the 1970s. It spiked during the unrest of the 1960s. and it spiked because of government civil defense policies during the 1950s. Millenarianism, or the belief by some religious groups in the imminent end of the world and the coming of paradise, has a long history. Apocalypse, it seems, is always just around the corner. In particular, though, end-of-the-world thinking spikes whenever unsettling events dominate the news. Social psychologists would say that these spikes are due in large part to the availability heuristic, which is to say that we rely upon information most readily available to us when forming opinions or making judgments. This means that we have a very predictable tendency to overreact to bad news. The infrequent bad things that make for big headlines get factored into our predictions about the future more than the commonplace good things that never get reported. Sure, awful things do happen, but these are quite rare. Our best guess about what's to come is better grounded in the recognition that life carries on. Almost always, a solution to our problems emerges through the natural, mundane processes of innovation, self-correction, evolution, and repair. Processes that aren't readily available to us when we contemplate stockpiling. If it isn't out of the ordinary, then it isn't news. Something worth keeping in mind as we assess what the news tells us about the state of things to come. Whatever we make of the news, it's worth bearing in mind that surviving tends to be the ordinary course of events. For City Views, this is Walker Smith.
Walker Smith is the president of Yankelovich, and he comes to us from Georgia Public Broadcasting. His latest book is Generation Ageless. If you want more information about the projects we talked about on today's show, you can find links to websites on our website, smartcityradio.com. You can also listen to the show again by subscribing to our podcast or register for our newsletter and get the info delivered straight to your inbox. Smart Cities web content and audio archive are supported by CEOs for Cities. National distribution is made possible by the Hyde Family Foundations, investing in programs that generate lasting change to improve the future of Memphis, Tennessee and its citizens. For more information, visit hydefoundations.org. Scotty Iseri is our producer and engineer. He's got a special message for whoever monkeyed with our website last week, but it's not fit for broadcast. I'm Carol Coletta.